I'm going to call a meeting of the Justice Committee to order, and I believe there's a quorum, and seeing that, I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes from our January 21st meeting. Thank you. Anybody want to make a correction on the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by no. Motion passes. And I believe we will be receiving information, genetic information in Minnesota report. And if you would please identify yourselves for the record.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, my name is Lori Barkowski. I'm the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division at the Department of Administration. And along with me is Stacey Christensen, also of my office. What we're going to be doing today is giving an overview of genetic information in Minnesota. What we have here is a follow-up report. This one was requested that the Commissioner of Administration convene a work group to develop principles for public policy use of genetic information, and this was requested of us in 2007. The report, you have the executive summary as well as these slides. The report itself is 114 pages, so we didn't print it off for everyone, but it is available electronically, and also if you'd like a copy of it, just let me know, and the link is at the end of these slides. The final report is divided into a variety of areas around the legislative charge that we were given. The first one is the Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System. Number two is the access by relatives to a three-generation pedigree. And I might ask everyone, how many people in the room know what a three-generation pedigree is besides perhaps Representatives Kahn and Holberg? I had never heard of them either, so at some point later, I'll tell you what they are.
Yes,
also, access to data as well as specimens maintained by the BCA, genetic information safeguards, as well as secondary uses of genetic information. I didn't see anyone jumping up to say they knew what that was. The process, and given that Representative Kahn's here, I'll say it probably a little bit differently. The commissioner, the work group that was convened, really had it was a group of stakeholders that was very diverse, and if you look at the list, it included the judicial branch, as well as the March of Dimes, Mayo Clinic, citizen members, insurance companies. It was really a group not destined to have a lot of consensus. So the fact that we had some consensus, I think, is a huge win, but for the most part, it was really there to make sure that we had all of the perspectives represented. So you will hear we didn't reach consensus on some areas, and there were some areas that were, I think, more hotly debated than others, so I'll try and highlight those as we go along. We met for a period of 14 months. So that's why the report is 114 pages long. We also broke into subcommittees to do some of the work as well. I'm going to turn it over to Stacey Christensen now. She's going to give you an overview of some of the current protections of genetic information in Minnesota and federal law as well.
As you'll see from the slide, there are actually a number of current protections in Minnesota. Minnesota has been kind of at the forefront in protecting genetic information. The first one you see on the slide deals with health and life insurance, and it's section 72A.139. That particular section defines genetic tests, and it prohibits health plans from requiring a genetic test and determining eligibility for coverage, among other things, including underwriting decisions. And it also requires informed consent from an individual who agrees to take a genetic test for life insurance purposes. The second statute currently in effect in Minnesota is genetic testing and employment, and that also defines genetic tests and also defines protected genetic information. And that particular statute prohibits employers from requiring a genetic test as a condition of employment or to terminate employment based on the protected genetic information that's defined. And then finally, there's a section in the Data Practices Act in section 13.386, which defines genetic information to include an individual's biological information or data as well as specimens. It classifies genetic information held by the government as private,
And it requires informed consent for collection, use, storage, and dissemination of genetic information. And Lori's actually going to highlight some of the issues surrounding that particular section later on in our presentation. And then finally, in May of 2008, President Bush signed the Federal Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. That particular piece of federal legislation doesn't do a whole lot more than Minnesota had already done in protecting genetic information. It deals with, it makes illegal for health insurers and employers to discriminate on the basis of genetic information. There are federal regulations that are currently being worked on, and so the full law will come into effect in November of 2009. On to the recommendations. The first recommendation we're going to talk about deals with the Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System, which is a program at the Minnesota Department of Health. And there was a particular charge in the legislation which said the commissioner and workgroup must determine whether changes are needed in Minnesota Statute Section 144.69 dealing with collection of information from cancer patients and their relatives. The workgroup was given an overview by the Department of Health as to what this particular program entails, and for purposes of this particular report, the main part that the group dealt with was the consent piece. Current law requires consent by a patient's attending physician or surgeon for the health department employees to conduct interviews with either the patient or their relatives. Relevant to this report because the interviews between health staff and the patients or relatives could include a transfer of genetic information. And so this is generally the type of disclosure that would require patient consent, which is why the group was asked to discuss this. The recommendation for this part was that patient consent was needed for interviews conducted as part of the program, as opposed to actually getting consent from the physician or surgeon. And if patient consent was not possible, the group outlined a hierarchy that would provide consent if, again, the patient was unable to provide consent. And that's provided on the slide. You'll see legal guardian, healthcare agent, spouse or registered domestic partner, next of kin, or personal representative. The report itself also includes suggested statutory language which would implement the group recommendations.
Representative Holberg. Thanks, Madam Chair. When you go through these recommendations, could you please let us know if there was consensus on the recommendation, if not, what the vote was, so we can get some idea of how much agreement there was on particular recommendations.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, for the most part, generally speaking, we had consensus. We did not take any votes, and when we did not have complete consensus, generally speaking, there were a handful, say 2 to 3 to 4 people out of the group of 20 that didn't agree. So it was relatively, you know, a smaller minority. And that's where we have the minority reports that are included as a part of the packet that detail where some of those strong disagreements were.
And Representative Holzer, if I might, in general, were those that were in disagreement with the recommendations those individuals that could be characterized as representing the public at large as opposed to government or a medical institution?
Ms. Byer-Krupinski? Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, I think that yes, you would say generally people who come from it from a privacy perspective as opposed to a medical or a research perspective might be really how you'd see, and the government perspective. We'd see how you'd, yeah.
All right, thank you.
Next up, what we have is the recommendation around the 3-generation pedigree. So as you can see on your screen, this little picture is what it is. And these can be super detailed and, you know, kind of not as detailed. As an older mom, I went through genetic counseling with my second child, and they met with me as well as my husband, and we detailed all of the different diseases or issues, genetically speaking, that we knew of from our family. So they collected all of this information about us. You know, I mentioned, you know, say crazy Aunt Betty or, you know, grandpa who had prostate cancer, a variety of different things. So we would mention this, and all of this would be taken down by our health care provider. We're people who have private health care provider. If I had been going to, say, a county hospital or a county nurse or a program like that where it was a government entity that was subject to the Data Practices Act, what happens in government is this recommendation number 2. When I talk about all the different relatives in my family, who is the data subject of that data? you would think it all came out of my mouth, it's all about me because it's all about my relatives. And in the data practices realm, I get the stuff that I say about me, but all the other people that I mention is data about them for the most part. And if I said, can I have my medical record back, a government provider would say, I need to black out these names because you can't have them back. So it's one of the most difficult areas of data practices that I didn't highlight for you 2 weeks ago. I was hoping not to have to explain this for a little bit longer. It's one that just doesn't make intuitive sense to folks. I could go in and talk to my boss and make a lot of, you know, share with her a lot of my concerns about different things. I could give her my opinion. I could be talking about lots of other people. And I could say, could I have that letter back? And she'd say, yeah, you can have about half of it back. And the extent that I'm talking about other people might be stuff that only they can see, even though it came out of my mouth. Does that make sense? So what we want to do in this first recommendation, Representative Mulroy, do you have a question? Okay. What we want to do in this first recommendation is it shouldn't matter whether or not your medical provider is a government person or in the private sector. That what happens in the private sector is my medical file, no matter what I say, who I talk about, all sits in a file all about Lori. So all of the counseling that was done before I had my son is all sitting in my medical record, even though my husband gave input and it's really all about Sam. That's what happens in the private sector. What we want to have happen here in this recommendation is that even if my provider was government, we're going to still treat that information as if it's all about Lori. And the next part then is if you, the legislature, decide, you know, we want relatives who might get mentioned in other places to be able to gain access to that, that you think about how to do that in a way that treats people who go to private providers in the same way as people who go to government. So if you think it makes sense that if I talk about my mom, she should be able to see the parts in my medical record where I talk about her, then write legislation so that people are treated in the same way, so that medical records get the same treatment. Does that make sense? All right, the next recommendation deals with access to data and specimens maintained at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And again, this was one piece that was set out in the legislative charge, which said the commissioner and work group must make recommendations whether legislative changes are needed regarding access to DNA test results and the specimens used to create the test results held by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension as part of a criminal investigation. Currently, just as a little bit of background, the BCA maintains DNA test results and human biological specimens as part of their responsibilities in performing DNA tests for law enforcement investigations. That law governs BCA's practice, which is 299C.155, and classifies the results of a DNA test as private. However, it only allows access to law enforcement and prosecutors and alleged perpetrators and subsequent criminal prosecutions. So that goes kind of against what we've been talking about in terms of a data subject. If the DNA test was taken of a victim, that victim would not have access under the current law, under BCA's current law. The victim would have access to a report that the BCA sends to local law enforcement agencies under another section of the Data Practices Act. But BCA doesn't currently send the full DNA profile to local law enforcement. It's just a report basically saying there was a match or there wasn't a match. So the first recommendation, recommendation one, deals with the DNA profile. And that recommendation is that the victim would have access to the DNA profile at the BCA, and alleged perpetrators would have access if certain conditions are met, such as during future criminal prosecution. The second recommendation is the report comparing the DNA profiles, so basically what BCA sends to law enforcement, there is a match, there's not a match. Again, the victim would have access to that report at the BCA, and the alleged perpetrators and their representatives would have access as provided in the rules of criminal procedure. And then finally, the recommendation dealing with the actual human biological specimen, that would, for victims, require a court order for access at the BCA. And for the alleged perpetrators, as allowed by the rules of criminal procedure during the proceedings, and then after any proceedings and appeals, it would be followed under the rules of criminal procedure. They would then require a court order for access as a victim would. Now we're getting into the recommendations related to genetic information safeguards. And as Stacy mentioned earlier, that first recommendation, we talk about the current status of Minnesota's protection, and that the group had a great deal of consensus around the idea of leaving the provisions that deal with life insurance and health insurance and employment, all the very strong protections that we have, to leave them exactly as they are right now. But where the group differed was that they really believe that there needs to be additional guidance from the legislature about Minnesota Statute 13.386, which is the treatment of genetic information held by government and other persons. And this legislation, because it doesn't have a lot of legislative history around it, and there was, initially when that language was introduced, it was coded in Chapter 144, which would apply to both, would apply to private sector medical providers as well as public sector medical providers. Ultimately, it was wound up being put in Chapter 13. And hopefully you remember that Chapter 13 deals with data and government. It doesn't deal with specimen stuff, and it doesn't typically deal with private sector. So we have this, you know, kind of lack of clarity about who this law applies to and what is actually being covered. So in addition to that, there are some terms that could use some further definition as to how are you going to get consent? Should you have consent from all the relatives if you'd like to do something?
Representative Kahn.
No, Madam Chairman, I guess I'd like to point out that a weird thing happened that I didn't know could happen, which was the bill as passed and signed by the governor was coded in 144. And somehow, in the next step that goes along the way, I don't know if it was in the advisor's office, it got coded into Chapter 13. And that was something that had a non-trivial effect in this. And I didn't know that that could happen, and I didn't know that that was something that we needed to look out for, or if it always often happens, or always happens, or whatever.
Ms. Baer, propensity? Madam Chairman, this isn't something that we've ever seen either, and it gets to the issue here. It has huge implications of what are the penalties going to be, who is going to, you know, what will it apply to, what does it protect, what does it mean? So clarity from the legislature would be very helpful in this arena to make sure that your intent can be implemented.
Would there be a point in re-putting it into 144 instead of 13? I mean, would that clear up some of the problems that we've had with it?
Ms. Byer-Kropensky.
Madam Chair and members, the group talked about leaving it both in Chapter 13 as well as putting it in somewhere like 144 where it would apply to there. One of the questions that I had was, do you want it to apply to just private medical providers or anyone in the private sector who's not a medical provider by definition who but also might get genetic information? I know, Madam Chair, members.
I just wanted to bring up before the committee that this weird thing happened, which had a big effect on this subject, and you know, none of us had ever heard of it happening before. So.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Representative Murray.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm knowing Representative Kahn about 30 years. I've never seen her without a word to say before.
He was Trump for a minute. Short minute.
Madam Chair and members, the second recommendation is about adding some additional notice of rights and informed consent requirements in a variety of different areas, including the direct-to-consumer genetic testing that you may have heard about in the news, as well as private research labs. In both of those instances, the group felt that while it might be paternalistic or maternalistic to have people, you know, kind of interfere with private contracting, there might be some things that we expect those people who do direct-to-consumer research and testing to be able to tell someone, I'm going to test your specimen for these things. I'm going to keep it for this long. This is who else I'm going to share it with. This, you know, I'm going to keep this forever and sell it to as many people as I want to, versus the contingent of folks who just wanted to say, you know what, people can contract, you know, they're buyer beware and leave folks that way. Maybe it's, you know, too many years in government, I think that maybe we should take care of people a little bit more than that. but that was one of the areas that we wanted to highlight. Additionally, for private health care providers, one of the things the group wanted to do was to add the treatment that the specimen is going to get to the notice of HIPAA privacy practices that people already get for their data. So the really long notice you get at your doctor's office would now say, and when we, you know, swab your throat for strep, we're going to keep it for 30 years and we're going to do it, you know, all the research we want on it. Whatever you're going to do with it, you kind of describe it in the same way what you're going to do with the data. That seemed like a really efficient way to give people notice in advance about how their specimens were going to be treated. So you could say, you know what, I think I'll go to a different doctor if I have that ability. Next up was on government. The idea was to extend something like a Tennyson-like warning to the specimen. So Tennyson warning is a privacy notice that people get when government collects private or confidential data from them. So before I go into public safety and I want a driver's license, they're going to tell me everything they're going to do with my data, why they need it, can I walk away, what are the consequences, who are they going to share it with. We wanted people to have that kind of same ability when you're going to take, you know, some blood from my arm or swab my cheek, let me know beforehand, you know, do I have the ability to walk away, and something similar to that kind of privacy notice before people have property taken from their body. The third recommendation is about the use and control of human biological specimens. And we borrow a lot of things from data practices because we're really familiar with that, is that both government and private sector who have these specimens, they've collected them for a certain purpose, should take steps to protect them. So in data practices, that means you take reasonable and appropriate security measures. So you lock your doors, you make sure you have a refrigerator on the sample so that they don't all, you know, kind of deteriorate when you're not looking. You make sure that my sample and my information is linked together so that you know that when you give me a paternity test result, it really is my test. You know, important things about keeping information and the specimens linked together and accurate and complete. And then also another thing borrowed from data practices, limiting employee access. Is there any reason why the receptionist at the clinic needs to be able to see the results of my paternity test? Probably not. So just like in data practices, you have people gain access to data and specimens who needed to do their work and not more. The next recommendation, number four, is about government retention of specimens. And that the group, and there was a lot of disagreement about this as well, that if a retention period wasn't set by law, so state or federal law would say you keep this for this period of time, that there should be a publicly available retention policy. So I should be able to look up any government that has collected my sample and know how long they're keeping the specimen. We also had a lot of debate about who should decide how long specimens are kept. Should it be the government who collects it? Should it be the legislature? Should it be some kind of independent group? So that's something where we left the really hard decision up to you to make. Who do you think should make these kinds of decisions about how long stuff is kept? The next recommendation is about the need for genetic information education. There's a great deal of education out there, but the group, even in consideration of the fiscal impacts, thought that there was some need for some more education, be it a brochure for citizens about current genetic information protections that are available, things of that nature. And the last set of recommendations we're going to talk about, the final charge, was the commissioner and work group must identify and make recommendations among options for resolving questions of secondary uses of genetic information. The first recommendation, or let me back up just a minute, the group used the working definition for secondary uses, and what they decided to use as the working definition was a secondary use of a human biological specimen collected for the creation of genetic information is one that has a purpose that is different from the stated purpose of the original collection. When considering whether a purpose is different from the stated purpose at the original collection, the perspective of a reasonable person in the position of the individual providing the specimen or data must be taken into account. That's what was used in making some of these recommendations.
So an example of that, ma'am, sure, would be if I go in to figure out if I have strep, I'm pretty sure that's all I'm going in for.
No, I'm the person who's giving the sample. You look at it from my reasonable perspective in giving it versus I show up at the BCA and give my fingerprint for a job and I don't understand. Maybe they're going to decide, have I ever, you know, are there any unsolved crimes related to those fingerprints? What I go into it thinking versus what the organization who gets it thinks its use is.
There was a committee, as Lori talked about, some of the work was divided into subcommittees. There was a committee that dealt specifically with secondary uses, and they discussed topics related to secondary uses in direct-to-consumer genetic testing, as Lori talked about before, in government programs, in insurance, in healthcare, and in the BCA's convicted offender database, which is the fourth and final recommendation I'll talk about. And as the membership of the group purposely included diverse members with diverse perspectives, as Lori highlighted earlier, these recommendations on secondary uses were provided to give as much guidance as possible on this particularly difficult area. The first recommendation includes considering the operation of court orders and gaining access to the actual human biological specimen. And kind of the guidance that, or the consideration that is wanted from you, from the legislature, is whether the current process should continue in requiring a court order for a human biological specimen. This is something the courts are greatly in favor of. Or with whether the courts should be given additional guidance, some sort of analysis, cost-benefit analysis, weighing, or if court orders should be completely prohibited at this type of access. The second recommendation is secondary uses without consent or court order. And again, this takes into consideration decisions of secondary uses, kind of similar to what Lori talked about in the genetic safeguards area. Who should make these decisions about secondary uses? Should it be government or private sector, the actual one that's collecting the specimen or entities, or specimen or data? Should it be a neutral state agency, something similar, or a legislative committee or commission, something at the legislature, or should it be a body similar to the Records Disposition Panel, which consists of the Historical Society, Legislative Auditor, and Attorney General. The third recommendation is prohibited secondary uses, and these are ones that the group agreed should always be prohibited. This includes any secondary use for specimens and data at the BCA, or secondary uses of genetic information or specimens collected to screen tenants for housing, to screen employees, or to issue mandatory insurance. And then finally, recommendation 4 deals with something commonly known as familial searching. This is a relatively new criminal investigative technique. And after much discussion about this particular technique with background from individuals at the BCA, to kind of summarize, this uses the BCA's convicted offender database to locate an unknown criminal who may be a close relative of a convicted offender who is already in the database. So again, after much discussion and background information, the group generally agreed it was important to highlight this issue as something that's very important for the legislature to be aware of, but really to learn some more about the science and any unintended consequences before a really educated recommendation was to be made.
Thank you. You're welcome. And Madam Chair, members, here's all our contact information. If you have additional questions, would like copies of the full report, would like to talk about, you know, kind of any of the different legislative drafting that has been included in the report that you'd like to maybe introduce, or anything you'd like to do, feel free to let us know.
Yes, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question going back to genetic information safeguards. You'd mentioned putting on something else onto the HIPAA disclosures, and I'm wondering, with that being, and as you put it, you know, the HIPAA disclosure, wonder with that being as large as, did the committee discuss at all about prioritizing maybe the things that you think are most important that the individual should know as kind of a highlight? I'm just looking at the most efficient way to get the what you deem the most important information out to the individual.
Madam Chair, Representative Kelly, we had a lot of those discussions about, you know, how much is in a informed consent, how much is in a Tennyson warning, and we all, you know, kind of different, you know, kind of lawyers in the room have different ways. They like lengthy. They want to make sure that every possibility is talked about. I might be someone who's on the other side, like, could you tell me in like four bullets what I really need to know so that I can be adequately informed? So I think people just feel differently about that on a personal level, and we didn't really have a discussion about could you prioritize. And we had more discussion about, well, you know, it's just going to get really long and no one will read it. But they still were gearing everything towards the person who really did want to be well-informed, and we write to that audience. So erring on the side of lengthier, which I think sometimes does a disservice to many of the rest of us who like things really short. You know, give me the highlights and no more.
Representative Kelly?
I'm sure just a quick comment to that. I guess the idea here would be to make sure that they read it first. And just from a common sense standpoint, if it's that long, they're not going to even hit the highlights of it, as opposed to maybe a prioritized list, and then go ahead with all the detail. You know, read the fine print, if you will. But here's what you actually should know, the most important thing to know about what's going to be shared with your information or not. Just a thought. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Holper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, though, if in fact they were collecting a specimen, and if you followed the recommendations of informed consent and they were going to use that for anything else other than that one test, wouldn't that your report require consent and then de facto tell them how long the sample will be used and for what purposes anyway, instead of going beyond the initial sore throat test?
Madam Chair and members, would it? We had envisioned that in the government sector, you would get a Tennyson notice in advance that would describe all of what was going to happen with your specimen. And if you didn't include it in that one and wanted to use a specimen in a different way, you would be getting then informed consent on the backside to use it differently or to share it differently. And in the notice of privacy practice, too, if you didn't detail a specific use, then you would have to be going back to get informed consent. We have disagreement, I think, in the group on if I say I'm going to use it for research, do I have to tell you exactly what kind of research, how detailed should the research description be? If I think, well, I have diabetes and all the research is going to be related to diabetes versus something else, what would a normal person, you know, expect to see?
Thank you, Andrew. Any other questions, members?
Thank you.
Is Twyla Braze in the audience? I understand you want to give some testimony today. And Madam Chair, before we're done, I would like to ask some questions of the Department of Health. They're here, so.
All right.
I don't know if it's on your list or not, but I do have questions for them.
Go ahead and please identify yourself. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Blaze. I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare, and I would just like to welcome you, Madam Chair, to the legislature. We've not met yet, and you're new. I had talked to Patrick, and he had put me down, but I didn't find that out until about an hour ago, but I still have put together some comments, so let me give those to you. They are all scribbled here. I am pleased to have been a member of the Genetic Information Work Group. One thing that I noticed on the PowerPoint that you got is after our name it lists U of M, and we're not U of M, so just so you understand that, in case you reference that again and you think that we're from the University of Minnesota, because we're not. During the discussion, those 14 months, it was very robust, it was invigorating, and there were a lot of points where there was indeed no consensus, which shows the diversity, I think, of public, corporate, and individual opinions on this matter of genetic information. The final report, from my perspective, was an improvement from the initial draft. However, I didn't feel that it sufficiently dealt with the concerns that I have regarding genetic information or what's at stake for the public for their privacy, and it doesn't really discuss, I don't believe, the idea of informed written consent, actual consent, as opposed to, if you figure it out, dissent, and then you can opt out. So thus I wrote one of the two minority reports, and as an aside, Susan Sillian Smith, an attorney who is also a member of the group, who is not here today, she wrote a minority report as well. And I just want to say that I think that her concerns about using the words public health as a rationale for having access to all our genetic information are underscored with, if you have the opportunity to read the health department's report and how they would like to change the genetic privacy law. I'm curious to see that you have received the minority report for consideration in your discussion today, and I think that I'll highlight just a few things for you from my report, particularly just from the first, it's two or three pages, the recommendations. A lot of the other piece gives you some information from experts in genetics and genetic privacy and the whole range of genomics and their concerns about genetic information. It also has a quote from a bioethicist down in Tennessee, I think, who comes here often to speak at the University of Minnesota. And then there are specifics regarding the report, but I think the recommendations are easy enough to read through. So the first thing I want to say, I just have seven things. The first thing I want to say is that the recommendations that I made are written with the express intent of protecting the individual's genetic privacy and their DNA property rights, and the very ability for them to shield from everyone what exactly their genetic profile is, their genetic propensities for disease, and all the things that could be used to harm them in employment, perhaps even marriage down the way, insurance, you know, who knows what your genetic profile could be used for. It is very interesting that very recently Google, one of the co-founders of Google, his wife runs 23andMe, and he decided to have his own genetic profile done. And then he was very unhappy when he actually had it done, because it showed that he had one of the potential markers for Alzheimer's. And now he's very unhappy. And this is something that, it's sort of like the right not to know. He made a decision, right? But a lot of parents aren't given the opportunity, for instance, in newborn screening, really to make a decision. To even have the right to decide, do they want this information or not? And do they want it on the record or not? The second thing is that the genetic privacy law was written to protect citizens, but the state health department has been ignoring it with the blood taken at birth from newborns. Those violations go on today as they are collecting it, storing it, using it, and disseminating it without the consent of parents. And Chapter 13.386 clearly says that the government and other entities must get the written and informed consent to do so. The third thing I wanted to say is that I was very concerned during our discussions when one of the representatives from Mayo brought up the recommendation that our DNA, our biological specimens, be treated as medical records. Now, the important thing to understand is that the medical record is very different from your DNA. You can look at your medical record and see what it says, but you have no idea what will happen when somebody takes your DNA and does an analysis of it, what will come out. So there are two very different things, but the second really important thing to understand is that today Minnesota law, the health records law, says that your medical records can be used for research by whatever institution has them without your consent, which would mean if they were treated exactly the same way, your genetic information, the organs that you leave, the blood, the urine, the hair, whatever you leave at the clinic or at the hospital, all of that could be used for genetic research without your consent, if your specimen is considered a medical record under that law. The fourth thing I want to say is that there's nothing more personal or private than your genetic profile. As I said, you have no idea how it could be used against you, but a lot of you know that the possibility is there and that in the past it has been used against people. The fifth thing is this idea of pedigrees. Now, we looked. We didn't actually see the creation of pedigrees in statute. We could have missed it, but we didn't see it. One of our concerns is that this pedigree, this attempt to put the pedigrees into law, is actually an attempt to do what is happening now without statutory authority, which is the same thing with the newborn genetic screening. there is no, the scheme is they have authority to do so, but there is no law for them to store, use, or give away to researchers the DNA and blood of newborns. And so that's going on without statutory authority. Our concern is that the pedigrees are going on without statutory authority, and if we put this into law, it legalizes what's being done now without authority. The other thing to consider is that 62J, this is statute 62J.301 and 62J.321, give the health department full access to everyone's medical record without their consent. So if you have the pedigree and you have the ability to create a pedigree using those, and people don't even know that pedigrees are being created on them through that law, and then through whatever might be added as a result of the recommendation here. The sixth thing I want to say is that we're very concerned about the plan to exempt the newborn screening program's collection, storage, use, and dissemination of the blood and genetic tests of newborns from the genetic privacy law. Because if you don't have genetic privacy at birth, and you're allowed to be tested genetically at birth, and your DNA kept for 2 years is what the proposal is, there's a lot that can happen in 2 years. And a lot of people are saying that now for DNA testing in newborns, they'd like to do what's called a microarray, where essentially you can get you can test a child for 1,000 or more conditions all at once. And if you know, understand Minnesota law, the parents don't have a right to just choose the PKU test. They have take the whole ball of wax, so whatever the commissioner decides to test the child for, the child gets tested for, not just for one condition or two conditions or five conditions of their choice. And the last thing that I'll say is that imagine what it would be like if patients figure out that the healthcare system is viewing them first as a valuable specimen for research, more than as a vulnerable patient, which is the only reason that they're coming in. They want to be part of research. You know, our organization is happy to have them say yes if they wish to, but that's why we believe in informed consent. But imagine what happens to the trust of the institution if the patients realize that they have no control over how they're tested, and the specimens that they leave, the blood that's taken from their arm, the urine that they provide for a simple test, now suddenly becomes part of a genetic research project, and they have no control over it. I wanted to just say those few things to you and to mention HIPAA, since you brought it up. Because HIPAA allows stronger state laws to rule. And so a state legislature can make laws stronger than the federal HIPAA rule. And the federal HIPAA rule does not protect the privacy of information. We consider it a data disclosure rule. And if you look at the Notice of Privacy Practices, and you will notice that that just tells you how your information is going to be shared and that you have no control over it whatsoever. And the little piece of paper that you sign simply says that you have read and received and you understand, essentially, that you have no control over what happens to your information, unless Minnesota law says differently. And Mayo Clinic does the very best job around explaining the difference, actually, in their notice of what the federal law rule says and the Minnesota law. And the Minnesota law has thus far been stronger, and we hope to keep it that way.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Bays, I'm the new kid on the block here, one of them anyway. And I have some constituents who were aware of this DNA testing being, basically confiscated from their child, and they were expecting, they went into the hospital and asked to opt out of this. And no one seemed to know what they were talking about. It went clear to the hospital administrator before, you know, they figured out what to do about that. So I guess I'd like to know what's in place right now for those parents, that the few that do know about this. How do they go about opting out of it? Are there forms to sign? What can they do?
Ms. Bray.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, I believe. Yes. Well, two things. One, the law says today that they shouldn't be able to take the DNA and store it, use it, or disseminate it. But that is the law that is being violated, right? And there's another law, and that's 13.386, the genetic privacy law. There's another law, which is a newborn screening law, which says that the parents can opt out of the testing completely, or they can opt out, or they can opt in and then have the blood specimens destroyed 2 years later. And those papers are available on our website and on the health department's website. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Kahn.
Madam Chair, Ms. Bray, looking at your minority report, one of the things that struck me is your recommendation 4, which says that government should not impose regulations on the direct-to-consumer genetic testing market and their contractual arrangements.
Right.
Could you kind of explain that?
Mm-hmm.
This is something that a lot of states have suddenly started showing some interest in.
Ms. Bray. Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, and I am looking back into the actual specific concerns that start on page 7, just so that I can make sure you know where we explained it in the report. Page 8, number 5. One of the things that I pointed out in there was that sort of the fact that there is this attempt here to make the private industry explain everything, while the health department has spent a lot of time making sure they don't explain anything. But the whole idea here is the idea of private contracts, and whether or not the individual who signs the private contract with the genetic testing company, whether or not you trust them to actually read the language, ask the questions, have the explanations, the private contracting company, or the, like 23andMe for instance, would be liable for anything that they violated in the contract. So, you know, it's sort of a question of do we want to add more regulations and thus more cost, or do we want to trust the private contracts that we have in other industry and allow litigation if necessary to take place?
Representative Holberg, you had a question?
Madam Chair, my question is for the Department of Health. I didn't know they were scheduled to testify or if they were just observing, but I had a question about their letter that they wrote in the minority reports as well.
We should have time for their testimony.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Braves? All right. Thank you. And we have a representative from the Department of Health. Can you please identify yourself?
Hello, I'm Kristen Longcourt from the Health Department, and I was not planning to testify, but I'm happy to answer questions. I did not serve on the work group, though. We had several members of our staff that did. Dr. Ruth Winfield, our state epidemiologist, representative epidemiologist, and Dr. Louise Leal from our Environmental Health Public Lab represented laboratories on the group. So I did not write the recommendations, but I'm happy to try to answer questions.
And Representative Holberg,
if I might, I hope you have a copy of the letter that the Minnesota Department of Health comments to the genetic information report, and I think members have it in their minority reports and appendix section. But I'm specifically looking at page 4 and your recommendation about how the Department of Health should be treated relative to the genetic privacy statute in Minnesota. And they added this whole new paragraph B, and basically the way I read it is it's kind of the Mack truck exception. It reads quite frankly like the law enforcement exception to some of the Data Practices Act. And so what I'm curious, and maybe you're not the right person to answer this, but I think the committee has the right to know this, given all of that language and all of those exceptions, when would the Department of Health be subject to that law?
Ms. Lockridge.
Madam Chair and Representative Holbrook, that's a very good question, and I think that's a much more technical question than I can probably answer. I think in crafting this legislation, or in crafting our comments to the report, because we were members of the work group, we wanted to provide some technical guidance or technical assistance, like we do many times for legislation, to just put some draft language that the Commissioner of Administration could consider. So I'm happy to try to get some more detailed information for you on that. I know that when they were crafting this, they were very specific to put the statements in as it was provided in law, because many of the health department programs have very specific guidelines that are crafted by the legislature in our statutes in Chapter 144 and 145. So that's about as much information as
I can. And I understand that. I just want on the record, and hopefully we can get a written response to that. But, you know, as I look at this, you know, and where you say, unless otherwise expressly provided by law, when you get down to, I mean, those of us have been around for a while, we've seen this language, when you get to including but not limited to, that's somewhere in here, item two, the end of the third line, including but not limited to, I mean, that broadens the opens the window even farther. And I'm just, after I read this, I'm like, well, when will the Department of Health? And I think the purpose here, at least I'll speak for myself, and maybe Representative Kahn can say if she disagrees, but I think our purpose in trying to get this information was to set some standards that all players would play by, and to see language like this come out of the Department of Health saying, well, it's good for everybody else, but we don't want to do this in all of these situations and not limited to these situations. I think kind of circumvents the whole reason for having some of these standards in our state. And then my other question was, is given these issues and working so much on the newborn screening information, I'm wondering, did the governor sign off on this letter? I mean, did he approve this language and recommendation? Is this the governor's position? And then you can certainly provide that in writing as well. But I'm just a little concerned, given some of the dialogue that we've had around newborn screening. I want to know whether or not he supports this broad exemption for the Department of Health related to genetic privacy.
We're happy to get back to that. Madam Chair and Representative, we're happy to get back to you on that.
And I appreciate that. Thank you.
But could I just comment on your first point? I think, through our comments, we really appreciated the Department of Administration's work on this. It's a very important issue. It's very important to our work. And I think public health struggles sometimes to explain our mission to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans and what it requires to do that. And so I appreciate our discussions on this issue, because it's very important that we that the department has the data and the resources that we need to maintain that mission. And it is difficult, and appreciate the conversation. So thank you.
Well, and Madam Chair, I mean, to that point, I hope that's where people disagree. What is the public purpose? What is the public standard? To what degree should individual rights to privacy be negated in turn for the public good, if it's really a public good? So, and I think that, I too am grateful for all the time and effort that went into this report. I think we've got some really good information. Some of the resolutions are going to be easy, and some are going to be very, very difficult. But certainly, I'm grateful to have the information, have the report. I admit I'm a geek about this stuff. I have read all the pages. I got all kinds of other questions that I won't waste the committee's time with, because I know you really don't want to spend the time at the end of the day. But I'd appreciate clarification on those two points from the Department of Health.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Any further questions, members? Yes, Representative Tom.
I just want to make a couple of comments on where we've had problems with this over about two or more years, or even further than that. I mean, the argument is made, but first of all, the Department of Health has some requirements to keep specimens for a certain amount of time for their federal qualification or their federal approval and so forth. And I think that's something that we certainly don't want to interfere with. There also is the argument of the usefulness of keeping it for research of some sort, which may be of use to the general public, may be of use to the individual. For example, if some defect is, which they're not aware of, how many things that Minnesota's looking for right now?
Ms. Rocker, Madam Chair, I'm Representative Kahn 53 currently.
Representative Kahn? More genetic defects, I think, than any other state.
Madam Chair, I'm Rocker, that's the full panel.
Yeah, that is the full panel. But the argument is if something else is discovered in the future that it might be incredibly beneficial to the family to know of, if they don't have a specimen, you know, they can't, they could go back and check for that also, but not if they don't have the specimen. So the issue that we were working on was the concept of the Department of Health ought to be able to explain this to people. They ought to be able to do it on an opt-out basis. And, and then for the people who think that their privacy is much more important than this possible future benefit, they ought to then have the option of having to have their samples destroyed, as I understand. And I think that one of the things that we got hung up in one of these sessions, I don't remember exactly which one it was, is how clear the information went to people while they were in the hospital when their newborn was, when they were having babies.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer, we were able to agree on what they thought they ought to see what it did, but the Department of Health somehow thought that was too intrusive into their research.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Kahn. Any other questions for Ms. Lockridge? Thank you, Ms. Lockridge.
Chair.
Okay. If there's nothing else on the agenda, this meeting is adjourned.